The book of Ephesians. We started at Ephesians chapter 1, verse 1, and we'll finish at the end of chapter 6, which means we study every verse, which means this is where we are this week. This is this week's, and it's in Ephesians chapter 5, verses 3 to 7. So let's read. But among you, says Paul, don't forget, we're to be imitators of God. We're to live a life of love just as Christ loves us, gave himself up for us as a fragrant offering and a sacrifice to God. But now he moves it into particular areas of human life. But among you, he said, there must not be even a hint of sexual immorality or of any kind of impurity or of greed, because these are improper for God's holy people. Nor should there be obscenity, foolish talk or coarse joking, which are out of place, but rather thanksgiving. For of this you can be sure, no immoral, impure, or greedy person, such a man is an idolater, has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God. Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of such things God's wrath comes on those who are disobedient. Therefore, do not be partners with them. Well, it's pretty sure to get somebody's attention this evening anyway, as we talk about sexual morality in today's society. I guess if I were to preach Christian doctrine, Christian standards of sexuality on the high street, people really wouldn't listen. I doubt it. I mean, they'd stop and listen, but they wouldn't agree. I took this quote from a book called The Seven Deadly Sins by Graham Tomlin, a theologian associated with the Alpha Course, Holy Trinity, Brompton and all that. He said, the reality is complex. On the one hand, our culture is fascinated by sex. At a deeper level, we live in a world that trivializes it. Alan Bloom catches this in his book, The Closing of the American Mind. He recalls a conversation in which a student wondered what all the fuss was about. His words were, sex, it's no big deal. His point was that sex was just normal, ordinary. Why make such a big issue of it? Many people find the traditional Christian teaching that sex should be kept for marriage strange, to say the least. Another student said, sex has been part of my life since I was 16. If I'm going out with someone and I love them, why shouldn't I have sex with them? It doesn't harm anyone else. It's our own business anyway. For her, Christian restraint on sexual behaviour was irrelevant. Everyone does it. Unrealistic. Do you really expect me to control my desires? And outdated. Contraception has changed all that. Question. The modern sexual standards, and you're considered a freak or out of date or Victorian or something else, something worse. Nowadays, you can see it in the media, you can talk to the students around in our university, you can talk to young people, just watch what's happening. Sex is just something that's done. By the time you're 20, many people, frankly, are bored with it. And yet, there's a cost to the new modern sexuality, sexual moralities. There's a cost. I came across this article in the Times about Shannon Matthews. Remember the story of the little girl who was kidnapped? Her own mother arranged her kidnapping by a step-uncle. For hoping to get money from a fund or rewards, whatever. And this was the article that was written. I found it very insightful by a journalist called Melanie Reed. Poverty has a new face now, and it's called Shannon Matthews. What her sad little story has destroyed, possibly forever, is the convenient middle-class myth of coherent material poverty. Instead, it is revealed that what devastates the lives of modern children is something altogether much worse, inner poverty, poverty of the soul. Although clothed and fed, often with a parent or step-parent in work, children in Shannon's world have to exist in a state of pervasive, low-level psychological chaos that is beyond the remedy of any social worker. There are no state palliatives for emotional neglect or an endemic lack of emotional stability. There is absolutely no cure for the horrors of growing up with adults who exist in a state of permanent volatility. In a world such as Shannon's, there are no certainties other than the fact that there are no certainties. These children are not like our children. Their parents are not adults we would recognise as adults. The children do not come home from school to someone asking them how their day was. Many are denied anything but fleeting attention, interest, and stimulation. Whatever is the truth, there is little doubt the family was chaotic. Shannon's mother, with seven children from five or even six different fathers, choose which paper to believe, cared for four of them, aged between 11 and 2. Others lived with their natural fathers. Before she disappeared, Shannon scribbled a note on a bedroom wall saying that she wanted to live with her father, a man who, fitting perfectly into the pattern of her fractured familial life, lived a short distance away but did not appear to see her with any regularity. Did anyone, we are entitled to wonder, offer this little girl the basic attention and stability a child craves? No one in the papers seems to connect that with modern sexual standards, but there's a connection when you think about it, isn't there? 2 years ago, a report by Ian Duncan Smith, and how often do you hear me quoting him in a sermon, says this: talks about some of the financial costs of such ills. Family breakdowns cost the UK taxpayer somewhere in the region of £24 billion every year, largely in benefit payments. If you include the educational underachievement and crime that so often go hand in hand with this, and the price tag spirals to over £100 billion a year. Now, you just think of the outcry there was about the banks. Now, you know, the banks, the bankers are rotten, grasping, bonus-seeking parasites on modern society. And we all hate them now. But £100 billion every year, according to Ian Duncan Smith, of course, you could say he's biased, but I don't think he's that far out, go on the cost of family breakdown. The duration of living together for a couple who are not married is 32 months on average in the UK. A woman who has a child in a living together relationship is probably going to be bringing up that child on her own by the time the child is 2.5. That's the norm in Britain today. Elaine Storkey tells with horror of a cartoon she saw in one of the chattering classes newspapers. Two women are talking, and one says to the other, "Is that really a man you want your children to spend every other weekend with?" You laugh at first, don't you? You chuckle, and then your teeth begin to grate together. "But among you," says Paul, "but among you, we don't want any of this. We want stable relationships between men and women among you." The ancient world wasn't so different from ours. Actually, before you start thinking I really hate myself when I start listing all the defects in modern society, but sometimes you've got to put things in perspective, haven't you? Ancient world wasn't much better. In fact, you could say it was worse. For men, at least. For women, it was sort of different. Women were expected to be faithful to their husbands if they had one. Those who didn't have a husband were in a more difficult situation. Many of those became prostitutes. And others who didn't become prostitutes became mistresses or concubines of men who were single or married. Demosthenes in the 4th century wrote, "We have mistresses for pleasure, concubines for the daily care of our persons, and wives to bear us legitimate children and to be faithful guardians of our households. Now, if you're a woman, you fit into one of those categories. If you're a man, well, you just had all those women at your disposal. Living with a concubine outside marriage was normal. Saint Augustine did it before he became Saint Augustine. But when he became a Christian, he didn't marry his concubine. He paid her off, sent her on her way, and became Bishop Augustine of Hippo. But that was normal. The life he was living was normal. It was normal for men in the Greek world to live with a woman outside of marriage. But he never intended to marry her. He would one day marry somebody who would give him social position and social status. He would have an official wife, but the concubine would do in the meantime. And he'd kind of look after in a way. For some women, that was the most they could hope for. Cicero, the famous Roman writer who upheld moral standards very strongly, ridiculed anyone who expected men not to frequent prostitutes and red light zones. William Barclay said that chastity was the only new virtue Christianity introduced into the world. All the others were well known in ancient writings, but chastity was something new. But among you, that word is there, but, isn't it? But among you. The Christians were to stand out from the ancient world because they had different moral settings. Different society, different mindsets, different practices. Because the Christians had boundaries. Paul talks about there shouldn't be obscene talk, shouldn't be rude jokings, but there should be thanksgiving. Sexuality was something to give thanks to God for. Sexuality, in Paul's views, was something to be enjoyed and to be talked about, and to be treated with thanksgiving as a gift from God. It wasn't to be ill-treated, it wasn't to be abused. But to stop it from being abused, it needed to have boundaries. Sex, it was a quotation, but I've forgotten where I quoted it from, which is why it's not quotation marks around it. Sex is not a private matter, somebody once wrote. It affects the whole of society. And the boundaries that you place upon sex ultimately have an effect on the kind of family that you create. And if you think that our British young people are the most drugged, most drunk, most unhappy, most pregnant teenagers in Europe, you've got to say, does that not have any connection with the sexual standards and with the modern pattern of living together with one partner after another? Bible says sex is not something to be ignored. It's not something to be despised. It's to be enjoyed. Rob Bell tells this story. Rob Bell has an excellent book on sexuality out, but it's very different to what you might expect from a Christian book on the subject. And he has this. His child said to his wife, "Mum, what does sexy mean?" Now, that's a challenge for a mum. What does sexy mean? And the child's mother said this: "Sexy means when it feels good to be in your own skin. Your own body feels right. It feels comfortable. Sexy is when you love being you." It's beautiful, isn't it? That's good. Sexy is when you love being you. And it's so easy to devalue, to diminish, to corrode, to tarnish your own sexuality by becoming something which you hate, something which you despise, something which you wish you begin to feel dirty if you don't have correct sexual boundaries. And Paul begins to list them, and it's not a pleasant list. He begins with porneia, the word porneia, meaning there must not be any hint of sexual immorality. The word is porneia, impossible to translate. It can mean incest, promiscuity, prostitution. In some cases in the Bible, it's used for premarital sex as well. The Jews said to Jesus, we're true children of Israel, we weren't born in porneia, or we weren't born out of wedlock like you were, because they heard the story that Mary and Joseph were only engaged when Mary got pregnant. So there was a dig at Jesus there. It's the word from which we deprive our word pornography. The Independent in 2006 said that we're a nation addicted to porn. 11 million people in Britain admit to watching porn online, devaluing their sexuality, making themselves uneasy in their own bodies. So I thought this was a good opportunity to visit my favourite pornography site. XXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXXX rates itself as the world's number one Christian pornography site. And just in case you're beginning to have worries, there is no actual pornography on the site, okay? You may visit. I do recommend it. It's an excellent website. It's an American website dedicated to ministering to people who have either addiction to pornography or are in the pornography business in America. And they have a confessions part where people write in about their experiences. There's this one. I've been on and off addicted to pornography for as long as I can remember, it says. I was exposed to it at a very young age, and since that point I've been returning to it methodically. As about a year and a half ago, however, I just got sick of it, sick of trying so hard to beat it by myself and falling on my face every time. And so then it goes on, I got the accountability software, and my friend and I are accountability partners. But he says he has a good month and then a bad one. I'm a young leader coming up in a church at the moment, and it breaks my heart to hear all of the stories of the respected leaders whose ministries and families fall apart because of secret addiction to porn. Porn really is the devil's stronghold in my life, and it leads me to other sins as well. And what struck me as I went through these, I just went through them, was again and again, the people saying, I began to be addicted to porn when I was 8 years of age, 9 years of age, 10 years of age, 11 years of age. This one, I'm 15, and I've been looking at porn ever since I was 8 or 9 years old. And that's the pattern of modern life for many young people. Now, those of us who are older just weren't brought up in that kind of situation. That's the reality of so many people. And that's why we need boundaries. Incidentally, can I just go off quickly on a tangent? If pornography is a problem, and it may well be for some of you, there is a way around that. XXXChurch.com has links to free software. You will need an accountability partner, not me. I'm here to pastors pick up pieces if it goes wrong, so not to me. Find yourself an accountability partner, and what happens is you can download a piece of software that records all the websites you visit during a week or during a month and sends them to your accountability partner, so that your accountability partner knows exactly which websites you visit. It works very well. I recommend it. And if that is a problem, you may want to talk to me about it, but XXXChurch.com has that accountability stuff there. Use it, recommend it to your friends. You need to do something if you're caught in pornography. You're not feeling good about yourself. You're feeling bad about yourself. Your sexuality has gone completely haywire. That's not what God made you for, is it? So you want to get out of that. You want to clean up your act. That's a way to do it. There are other boundaries as well. I just make sure that there's no porn on my computer. And so I can take my computer anywhere. Any church member can look at my computer. It's porn-free zone. And I keep it that way. Make sure it's that way. Just have to. I'm the minister of the church. It has to be that way. Have to live in transparency. Can I suggest that you do something similar? And I came across Rob Bell comments on this interview with Hugh Hefner. Hugh Hefner was the founder of the Playboy empire. Yeah? Got the man? Playboy, bunny girls, porn, Mr. Porn himself. So what he says, he did an interview with a friend of Rob Bell's. Sitting on his couch in his Playboy mansion in Los Angeles, he talked about his upbringing. I was raised in a setting in which sex was for procreation only and the rest was sin, he says. Our family was prohibitionist, Puritan in a very real sense, never hugged. Oh no, there was absolutely no hugging or kissing in my family. There's a point in time when my mother later in life apologized to me for not being able to show affection. That was, of course, the way I'd been raised. I said to Mum, you couldn't have done it any better, and because of the things you weren't able to do, it set me on a course that changed my life and the world. And that's what Rob Bell says. Actually, what happened was the guy's problem, the guy's inability to form a stable relationship and his obsession with sex comes from a childhood that was abnormal, that, where people weren't comfortable in their own skins. They didn't feel sexy. They didn't have the correct boundaries. There was no touching, no hugging, no mention of sex. And it produced this monster called Hugh Hefner, who's done the world little good. So Paul says, sex should be treated with thanksgiving, but there are limits. Don't have anything that devalues your sexuality. There should be no sexual immorality, nor any kind of impurity, he says. Your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit, of course. And there should be no impurity. It's just incidentally on the XXXChurch.com, I found this comment from a woman. It's not all men by any means on their website. She said, sexual sin has been a battle for me for many years. It used to be in premarital sex, but it has persisted in other forms for 4 years since then. Last night I started watching porn. I tried to repent, but my mind was restless. All day I have been struggling and failing. Today I know it has to stop here. God has granted me freedom. I am not meant to be a slave to anything. I have shorted myself of God's gifts. I've created more lies, more things to prevent our relationship from progressing. Tonight I will sleep and praise the Lord. Tomorrow I will live for his glory. And another woman called Christine, this was on January the 2nd, they were writing this year. She says, I'm in the same boat as you, sister. I feel like a gypsy myself. No idea what that means in American. Americans here can perhaps explain it to me afterwards. And what the Lord has to offer. The thing that the hardest for me was to admit to another woman that I had this addiction. I thought this was only normal for guys. But three amazing girls from my youth group pray for me and do not judge me. Do not be afraid to reach out to fellow sisters of Christ because you're not alone. God bless you. I'll be praying for you tonight. So Paul says, listen, make sure there's no impurity, no cheap talk. Don't cheapen sex. No greed. The word greed there actually means sexual greed. It doesn't mean financial greed in this context. It's addiction, sexual addiction. And Rob Bell says this. Lust says to us, if you just had this, everything would be fine. But it's not true. We wouldn't be okay. And we have closets full of clothes to prove this. We thought that shirt and those trousers would change the way we feel about our bodies, about how others perceive us, about how comfortable we are in our own skin. And then we got them, and nothing changed except the size of our bills. Lust promises what it can't deliver. We cheapen our sexuality by not putting boundaries in place. We cheapen our own sexual attraction, our own feelings for ourselves, our own sexuality, our own sexiness. Time is running out. Big subject. Let me finish with a story. It goes back to the days of the Belsen concentration camp. And it was liberated by the Allies. But they were left with a camp full of starving people. Many of the starving people died before they could be brought back to full health. And the colonel in charge, a man called Colonel Gonin, was in charge of trying to get the camp back together. It was shortly after the British Cross arrived, he said, that a very large quantity of lipstick arrived. This was not at all what we wanted. We were screening for hundreds and thousands of other things, and I don't know who asked for lipstick. I wished so much I could discover who did it, because it was the action of genius, sheer, unadulterated brilliance. I believe nothing did more for these internees than the lipstick. Women lay in bed with no sheets, no nightie, but with scarlet red lips. You saw them wandering about with nothing but a blanket over their shoulders, but with scarlet red lips. I saw a woman dead on a post-mortem table, and clutched in her hand was a piece of lipstick. At last, someone had done something to make them individuals again. At last, they could take an interest in their appearance. That lipstick started to give them back their humanity. Rob Bell says, because sometimes the difference between heaven and hell may be a bit of lipstick.